What makes a good network design? Is it meeting all of the technical requirements of the business? Is it coming in way under budget? That's always a good thing. Maybe it's making sure that the network is as resilient as possible, regardless of the budget. Or maybe it's just following the network vendor's validated design guide right down to every single config snippet. Well, anyone who's worked in this business for more than 5 minutes knows the answer. It depends. It depends on a lot of things, actually. And today, my good friend Brian Gleason, a veteran network engineer, veteran sysadmin, network architect, and currently a sales engineer with Juniper, is joining me to talk about what makes a good network design. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Hey, Brian, it's good to see you, man. I have been looking forward to talking to you for a long time. I remember when we first met in person, at least, it was at, I think it was at Cisco Live, right?
Yeah.
And it was, that was 2018.
2018 in
San Diego. That was actually my first time in San Diego and fell in love with it. And I've been back a few times since. I went with my wife once for a long weekend. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was great. It was great meeting you in person and great seeing you again today. Really is. So I know your experience because we're friends. So I know from your, you know, just knowing you for the past few years, your extensive background as a network engineer turning a wrench, as a solutions engineer, solutions architect, whatever mm-hmm. you folks call pre-sales engineers, and working in the security space, working in the campus, working in the data center, all these areas. So you have a really broad experience. So what I want to talk to you about today is network design. You've seen it all. You are a veteran engineer. So starting off with kind of this, maybe it's an unanswerable question, but what, in your opinion, makes a good network design? And you can answer that question in the context of the campus and the data center, or maybe there's some even more broad concepts that sort of cover everything. But what do you think makes a good network design?
Well, let's see. That's a nice question because I think it almost differs from whether or not you're in the trenches or if you're trying to sell or you're trying to be a VAR. Like if you work for a VAR,
okay.
You're trying to help someone meet the needs. If you're in the trenches, I think there's a couple of other goals. One is, can you do it within your budget? Can you meet these vague designs that that some business unit has given you? And then how do you make your life easier? Because most network engineers in the trenches just want to sleep in the middle of the night. They want the network to be self-healing. Mm-hmm. So if your design kind of works to meet those business goals and keep you asleep, can fix itself, it's probably a good start. So if you're on the VAR side and you're trying to help make a design, that's where you need to look at best practices. How do you build in redundancy and resiliency and still meet the needs of your customer? On the OEM side, on the vendor side, you want to sell them the correct part. Don't just go in for cheap, but you want to make sure that the parts that you're giving them meet their needs for a longer term. So it's going to be things like investment protection, stability. Do they really need bleeding edge, or can you be a partner with your customer and not just a, you know, wham bam thank you ma'am kind of thing? So that's kind of broad.
Well, yeah, and I posed it in a broad way because I'm trying to start off by at least identifying those main concepts that we can then drill down into. And, you know, right off the bat, you mentioned reliability, stability. Uh-huh. Those are the things that I know, especially on the enterprise side, but of course in the service provider realm, whether that be web scale, hyperscale, e-commerce, really anywhere that you are networking, which is like everywhere today, I find that network operators really value stability and reliability.
Yes.
And fault tolerance over everything else. So I believe that a good network design starts with that as the foundation. And within that, yes, there are business constraints. There are cost constraints. There are technological constraints as far as what features are available and what engineering staff you have available. Those are all there as constraints and considerations in your design. But I really believe that it starts with this foundation of stability, resiliency, because I think you'd agree the network doesn't exist for itself. It exists for the express purpose of application delivery. Well, any service delivery, but it's usually in the form of an application. And then do you know Tony Ifantis, by the way?
His name sounds familiar. Yeah.
Okay. Tony was on this podcast a while back, and I remember we were having this conversation, and he actually corrected me and said, you know what? It's not actually application delivery. I mean, yeah, it's application delivery, but even that is a proxy for end users, mm-hmm. people accessing their data.
Correct.
So that's really what the network is all about, is making sure that human beings and then machines to machines can access information, access data.
The network customer is every butt in a seat in anywhere across the globe. So it's...
Yeah, exactly. So how do you design a network so it's reliable, resilient, and performant and all those things? I mean, yeah, that's when you start to then consider, okay, who are my engineers that are going to be managing this on day two? How much money do we have?
Right.
Where are we today? You know, that's another consideration. You know, what does the network look like today? And therefore, is this a gigantic rip and replace? And then what does the design look like then? But yeah, I feel like that it's kind of an all of the above thing, and not as much on, I don't know, platforms and specific, you know, switch and router.
And the thing is, I think I always like starting with some of my constraints, because knowing those and having those kind of defined really gives me it sort of shortens the leash a bit on what I can do to meet, you know, those expectations and provide the best service for my users, all those seats. And typically, once I kind of know those constraints, I can almost design something like we can do this for this thing, a good, better, and best approach, right? So at least now your business units and all those people that have constraints on your service or that are providing or making constraints on your service, you can at least say, if we do it this way, then it'll meet your need, but you're going to have you'll have these potential problems, like maybe you're not quite as reliable. You don't have redundancy within the network, and maybe that's okay because you're a very, very small office or you're a home office. Like if you're reaching out to small office, home office, especially after the pandemic and everybody's working from home, kind of you're just needing edge connectivity, and you're not so much worried about redundancy there, right?
Right.
So those types of who are you trying to service helps dictate how you're going to design the network.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, who is the actual end user in this case? Is it the city of Chicago because you're a service provider, or a region, a geographic mm-hmm. region in the world? And then you start. Then a good network design is going to have these transit paths, and you're going to look at these peering relationships and the cost associated with
Correct.
Them. And so your requirements, business constraints, technical constraints, they change as a result of the nature of who your end users are. And if you're let's say a large medical facility, like a healthcare system, where it's like a bunch of hospitals and data centers, it's still huge, but much more traditional. And maybe there is literally no tolerance for risk in those scenarios. Yeah. Remember, like, you don't hear it that much, but the whole like fail fast, fail often kind of mantra that we heard for a few years, and it sort of spilled into networking, and it was the idea of being agile and all these things. And I'm like, I wouldn't tell customer, you know, hospital X that it was all about stability and reliability above everything else, like beyond, you know, anything. But then, like you said, therein lies a cost. So, you know, you go to your customer and you say, in this particular data center, how mission critical are these services? Because if we start doubling everything, and you know, to increase fault tolerance, and then we want to also improve fault tolerance at the hardware level, and we're putting in an active standby or active firewall thing, whatever. You start doubling your cost. You start doubling licensing cost, mm-hmm. and maybe. Then you got to double that in your standby data center. I mean, it goes up exponentially.
Yes, it does.
Double the cost of optics, double the cost of the actual resources under it, double the cost of power and cooling, and do you have the rack space? And then the complexity of that, you know, I know having done those kind of projects, I'm going to go back to healthcare because that one, for some reason, it's very top of mind for me. You get into some of those scenarios where they're like, well, we need we need absolutely no downtime. You know, we're talking about physicians and operating rooms and all this sort of thing. I'm like, okay, absolutely understood. And then you look at who's going to manage this thing on day two, and you look at their staff, and they have an entire staff, but they're outsourcing almost all their high-level engineering, and you know, they just have kind of lower mid-level for the day-to-day. And I'm like, I mean, we're talking about some pretty advanced routing concepts, so all your links are being utilized and active and load balanced, so that way, yes, it's both fault-tolerant and performant, where we don't have idle links and idle devices and all that sort of thing. And it gets me nervous. I actually remember maybe it was before the pandemic, so 2019, early 2020, I had one customer in New York, just north of New York City, hospital system. And that it got me, I'm not even joking, Brian, I got nervous where I was like laying in bed at night and talking to my wife about it. Like, I don't know, I'm scared this hospital is going to go down. You know, if somebody whittles the wrong wire. Yeah. I don't know if that ever happened because I ended up leaving that company, but that's those are all the things that we think about in network design. And me, in my experience on the enterprise side, you know, it's not really as much about protocols and platforms and things like that.
So. Yeah, most vendors are going to use the same Broadcom chipset, or they use merchant chips, so you're going to have some very similar performance metrics anyway. It's
true.
Some vendors will do things better than others. Maybe the CLI or the management or API calls or all that kind of stuff is more fully developed. So when you start thinking about maybe day two operations and you can start moving into automation, then you're controlling what thing is being pushed out onto which servers which routers and switches. You can do it a lot more tested and controlled, and you're not worried about as much fat fingering a policy, a routing policy to take your network down. Then it becomes just, you can do sort of more with less, I think, as long as you start to standardize how you're deploying your VLANs and your routing policies and that kind of thing. So your design becomes much more important for day two operations, especially when you start getting into automation and orchestration and things like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it sounds, and that's not something I was even thinking about. What you're talking about is a good network design is setting yourself up for success on day two.
Absolutely.
It's not just purely like, is this a very performant and resilient network, which it should be.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's already, those boxes have been checked. But it's now, can we run with this moving forward?
Right.
And if you can't, then there's a problem, and maybe it's not a good network design. Yeah. Interesting.
Phil, you actually mentioned it too. It's like a good network design is actually going to take into account the skill set of the people that actually have to manage the thing, right? So if you have people with very limited experience in managing a network, and you're doing and you've got a 10,000 node data center with spine leaf and super spines and automation, it's going to be very, very difficult to have a stable network, because the people running it don't have experience and understanding. So,
however, I would say that if that is the technology that's required for the services being delivered, then it is what it is, and they need to staff up.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, you don't have the right staff, we're going to give you this Mickey Mouse network. Well,
you
can't run your hospital on a network.
Right.
Go get some better engineers.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
I do think that there is a balance there.
Yes.
And I also think that if you're designing your network in such a way where you need constant massaging by engineers, then maybe it's not so stable and reliable.
Right. I used to argue, look, the network shouldn't be a boutique shop. We should have small, medium, and large.
Yeah.
And we're going to be kind of Walmart, right? When you come in, you know what you're going to get every time. And and that, again, that goes to having a stable network, right? If you're doing these one-offs, then when something goes bad, it takes forever to figure out where the problem may lie.
Sure. Then you start incorporating tribal knowledge lack of documentation.
Exactly.
I was almost said documentation, but it's
right.
Lack of. That's what Greg Farrow used to say that all the time. That every network is a snowflake, and we love our little snowflakes,
yes,
and we care for them and all of that. So now what about today? I mean, here we are, 2023, 2024, and, you know, our network is public SaaS providers and cloud. We don't own that stuff. Maybe we're using DNS services. Again, we don't own that. We're relying on the public internet because we got rid of all our MPLS, or maybe we're using some MPLS, but it's much more hybrid. Mm-hmm. And so now we're relying on an SD-WAN, right, that runs over the top of the public internet. Again, something we don't own or manage. So, yeah, that to me, today's designs, a good design today is going to look different than a good design 15 years ago. However, conceptually, the goals are the same: reliability, performance, day two management, all those things, like you said, like we've been talking about. But it is going to look different. You know, it's which overlay are we using for our public network? What are we using to exchange routes? Is it, you know, how to what extent are we relying on our public cloud provider for resources?
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can balance that and mitigate that risk. What do you think? Today, is it really the same as it's always been, or do you think that there's new considerations there?
You know, I think probably about like you said. I think the concepts are still the same. Like you still have the same types of requirements, the same needs to get the best bang for your buck, the fastest speeds, end user expectations. In fact, you know it. Do you remember we had this thing called SLEs, service level expectations? It's not how the network is performing. It's how is your end user actually experiencing the network. So
yeah,
right. So I don't care if something goes down as long as my user is still able to attach to the network, able to connect to certain things.
You care a little bit.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, you care a little bit.
But it doesn't. As long as I don't have someone yelling at me because the network sucks or it's down or nobody's getting on, and I can still say, mm-hmm. actually, the network's still up, and you're still seeing the same metrics, I'll just go and replace this device that you think is causing the problem. But then it's sort of mm-hmm. meantime to innocence, right? So those are still concepts that are there, but the technology is changing so much that it's sort of a how do you use the innovation to maintain or improve your ability to meet your customers' needs and goals? So you mentioned mm-hmm. SD-WAN. I mean, I remember back in the day when it was policy based routing, right? You'd mm-hmm. have to define these particular source destination addresses and these particular ports need to go out this other interface. And then everything else would come down my frame relay network or my MPLS network. That was all manual. Well, mm-hmm. we did that because you needed to isolate certain applications for the speed and for the performance, right?
Right.
Well, now yep. SD-WAN can do all that stuff automatically. You carve out the classes and which applications you think that are already pre-canned. You get on your little controller. You go check, 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 push. And now you're getting metrics back applications can be punted over different services or over different circuits based on latency or all these other bandwidth and network health metrics. So yeah. it just gets a little easier, but it also gets a little more complex because you can't just sit back and go, well, I know RIP and and so it should just work. You have to keep learning something new. You can't be stale in this type of career. So
yeah, for sure. We still want that reliable and stable network, and now the complexity is such that you have to learn new technologies in order to continue to have that reliable and stable network. So that's still the core. It's still having a high performance connectivity to the applications, ultimately the data, right, for a human being to get to. It's just how that happens is different.
Yeah.
And so... Yeah, so there was a day when we were talking about like, oh, the coolest new top of rack, end of row, and then data center core switching and lossless connectivity for vStorage and vMotion, I said it wrong. It's been a long time. those were the things that we needed at the time to provide a performant and resilient network. And today it's the same concept. We want a performant and stable network, but maybe we're talking about spine leaf. Maybe we're talking about AI workloads and extremely high bandwidth and scheduling a fabric as opposed to just, you know, hash-based ECMP. Yeah. So there's different tools that we need in 2023, 2024 that actually solve the same problems, that produce the same result.
Yeah.
Just in the context of where we are today. So it's interesting stuff. It never ends. You know, I work in technical marketing now, so I'm not quite as close to the technology as when I was literally out there turning wrenches, you know, tightening bolts, like literally turning wrenches. And then at the CLI, and then eventually as a systems, rather a solutions architect designing, which was still very close to the tech. But even now I see it, interaction with customers, interaction with the engineers in my own company, that it's just, it's a constant like, wait, what just came out? All right, I guess I'm studying that tonight.
Yeah, yes. You know?
And it really is.
It's funny because I think, you know, if you're, at least when, I won't speak for everybody, but when I was on the VAR side, I can remember going into certain customers and they'd ask, you know, some specific question about a technology. I'm like, geez, I'm just one chapter ahead of you right now, but I've got, right. I've got enough.
But they never knew that.
They would never know that, yeah. But you can at least talk to them. Yeah. And as long as you said something, if you have a VAR that will always give you the answer all the time. And, you might want to just be a little suspect. You should hear, you know, I don't know, but give me a little bit and I'll come back and give you the information. Part of it, especially on the network design part, is like Pharaoh says, you know, this is our little snowflake of the network. Sometimes there are specific requirements that your business has that your VAR, who's trying to help you get the best design, doesn't know about. So if you have a good relationship with them and your network architect for your partner says, you know, I don't know, but let me go back and look. You got to expect that he or she has enough resources than you do to help find that answer. So there should be a pretty good partnership between network engineers when you get into the design phase of your network.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, as we start to actually build the design out and start selecting routing protocols and platforms and where things go and how things are connecting, it really does depend on what the customer's requirements are. And that does include all of those things that we've discussed, like cost and performance requirements, you know, what thresholds can we not exceed, you know, things like that. And that's going to determine whether it's a good design. Whereas that same design handed to a different customer might be absolutely terrible. Right. It just doesn't meet their needs. As an example, I had a healthcare, going back to healthcare, a healthcare customer in the Midwest. Yeah, I don't know. It just happened to be. But out in the Midwest, and they had many, many, they had a bunch of hospitals. I think a dozen hospitals, six data centers. They were in GCP. They were not in Azure or AWS. Mm-hmm. And we were designing an SD-WAN, and one of their requirements was that they could not exceed something like 35 milliseconds of latency on any link. So they were all fully MPLS, leased lines, private, everything, yeah, everywhere because of that. And it was specifically because of their imaging devices, MRI, PET scans, CAT scan, all that stuff required very, very low latency. And it was mission critical. We're talking about, you know, people's lives. So that was a technical constraint, which turned into a business constraint as well, because it tied to cost of that particular SD-WAN design. And in that process, we therefore did not go with certain vendors or certain topologies because of that. And so that was a determining factor. Whereas with other customers, and I've worked with, I remember one customer here in the Northeast where I live, it was a chain of pet stores, pet food, yeah, you know, and toys and fish tanks and that kind of stuff. And there was a whole bunch of them all over the Northeast. All they cared about was like, did the access to the, you know, the internal website, which at the time was still internal, not in the cloud, did the customers have access to that? Not customers. I mean, the internal folks have access to it. And did credit card transactions go through? That was, and, you know, the inventory wasn't a huge thing because it wasn't like TCP kind of correct itself. It got through eventually. That was it. That design, that SD-WAN design, very, very different. Still, and I hope the customer thought, was still a good design, but completely different than the healthcare system. So
it's requirements. You gotta know what you're designing too. Otherwise, you're just kind of, hey, here's a box of stuff, and I'm gonna dump it on the table, and however it comes out, that's since you're not giving me any requirements, then I'm just gonna plug stuff in.
Although I do have to say, I was with VARs for most of my career, and many times when I was an engineer and not the solutions architect doing the design, yeah. So I got the statement of work, and I'm looking at it, and I'm reading through it, and I'm in a kickoff meeting, and I'm like, this is not going to work, or this is ridiculous. Like, this is such an overkill. Clearly, this was an effort to pack as much margin on hardware as possible on this yep. particular deal. And so much of this stuff is going to sit idle or is completely unnecessary, or they're never going to touch this once I set it up. They have three engineers back in the back office there, and they're never going to touch it.
It's never roll out. It's going to just sit
there. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, all right, fine. You know, the account manager made bank on this one, and I installed it and put it in, and we moved on. But I saw that very often. And I would say that it met all the requirements. Apparently they paid for it, so I guess it met the cost requirement as well. So I mean, in the purest sense, it's still a good design, but I did notice, like, there was a lot of overkill. There was a lot of, unnecessary over-engineering, yep. that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. That happens probably more times than it should. And I think it's just because, I think it's just requirements. If you don't have those things documented, then it's really hard to go, this is the best solution for what we need to accomplish.
Yeah. And then be able to discern and say this here. Yeah, I get it. It meets the requirements, but this is all completely unnecessary. Right. I'm spending an extra $800,000 I don't need to spend. Yeah. What about validated designs? You know how like Vendor, Cisco, Juniper, I'm assuming Arista and the other big vendors, they have these validated design guides, right? You work for Juniper, yes. So I don't know what you call them internally, but what about those? I mean, that's the actual vendor saying, hey, this is what a design should look like. Maybe that's the answer. Just follow those and call it a day.
Yeah. So that's probably a pretty broad topic too. And we can almost dive into a lot of little, we could follow a lot of trails on that one. Validated design guides are probably the most underused, documents out on manufacturers' websites. I really do, and part of it, I think is if you've never really looked at them, they can be kind of challenging. I mean, they should be pretty dense, right? They should cover a multitude of ways to deploy a product that will give you the reliability and performance and all that kind of thing. So I think one of the best things that you can do is if you're going down this track, use those validated design guides. They will give you sample config scripts. They'll give you deployment strategies. They'll give you case studies, and all those things have been developed and worked on by the vendor. So, you deploy this thing as the design guide says. When you call back into for technical support because of an outage or something's going on with a piece of hardware, you can say, "Hey, I went to page 400 in this design guide, and it helps your support staff understand your topology rather than try and draw it down on a napkin as your stress level is increasing and their stress level is increasing, that things get missed. So it just gives you that block. Like I said, network should be kind of small, medium, and large, and try and stay away from boutiques. And the design guys.
Yeah. Well, in as much as we can, I mean, we have been talking about how there are requirements, like a particular application that you're running that has a specific threshold. Therefore you employ a certain feature set. Whereas in another network, you don't employ that feature set. So I do think that no matter what, we're never going to get into a true, pure, small, medium, large stamp out network. As I'm saying it out loud, I think a lot of networks can be small, medium, and large, just not all. Yeah. I think a lot of them. Now that I say it and I think about back on my experience, most of the time, unless you're getting into like really high-end day trading and certain healthcare, most enterprise networks, as far as I'm concerned, it's like, all right, you're fine. Yeah. probably even service provider. Most service providers, in my experience, have really similar needs, like get this packet in and get it out of my core as fast as possible. You know, I don't want it in the network. Let's move it. And you know, what's the most efficient path to get there as well?
Yeah.
But this is the thing too, Phil, if you
use those design guides, it does give you that, you know, those building blocks. And if you have to bolt on a little, you know, a little nuanced thing for a, you know, for a business unit, you can, you've got the ability to do it. And then it's, you know, then it's just, you know, I hate to say it, but you do have to go back and at least document it and say, this is what it's for. These are the requirements, that this is the reason we have that little piece.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the validated design guides do give you that foundational element, those building blocks, like you said, to say this is what a reliable and performant network looks like. And of course, it gets you like maybe 80% of the way there, 90% of the way there. And in some cases, because the network, or rather the customer, doesn't have these, you know, very, very specific requirements, maybe even close to 100% of the way there. Yeah. It is completely determined on vendor, though. So, you know, if you're an entirely Juniper network, okay. What about in these hybrid networks today, when we're talking about multi-cloud, we're talking about data center might be vendor A, your WAN might be vendor B, security devices might be vendor C. You know, what do you think about that in that scenario?
Yeah, so in that sense, again, I think if you're if you looked at Juniper, Cisco, Arista, the topologies and the architecture are going to be very, very similar, right? In your data center, we're all pushing, you know, 3-CLO, 5-CLO architecture, spine leaf, use BGP for routing. So one of internally, so one of those things that you kind of want to look at, like your configuration, the things that you're going to bang on the keyboard are going to be obviously a little different from, you know, from vendor to vendor. Certain technologies may not be supported on a certain platform. So those would be, you know, little changes. But one of the things you have to look at, do these particular vendors for interoperability, are they doing proprietary things, or are they doing standard things? And when they say, when the manufacturer says, yeah, we write to the IEEE standard or this RFC, what does that actually mean? So are you supporting all of that RFC, or are you supporting just a portion of that RFC? And would it still be interoperable? So for example, there's a document that I came across on our side that talked about how to make a between Juniper and Cisco, the EVPN VXLAN. And there are a couple of differences. There's some nuances on how the frames and the packets would be exchanged between these two devices. We can do it. It's just, you're probably not going to see that in a validated design guide. You're just going to have to do a little bit more digging, right? And again, the vendors do test interop, and they do put all this stuff down. Mm. So
it is in the design guides.
Yeah, you can read about doing you know, how to set up your network. But you know, for the example that you're talking about, interoperability, you know, that particular piece may not be in the design guide, but you could actually go off to another, you know, you may link off to another document and go, okay, I need to do this between this vendor and this vendor. Are there known issues?
Right. So it sounds like that validated design guides give us standards, baselines kind of for what the vendor says, this is what a deployment looks like, sort of a thing that we can go and refer to and use our starting point. And then from there, like you said, you can jump off into even, you know, more specific information like interoperability and things like that.
You got to start somewhere, and the design guides really, really help.
Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, especially if you're talking about changes that happen in versions and distributions and code versions. Like, I'd like to see, okay, we have this new feature that was rolled out, or we have this new software version and these wireless controllers, whatever. You know, what is the design supposed to look like? How do those join messages get sent now? And how does that play into like the client devices? Like, I do want to go read all that first. And so, that is very, very important to me to design a good, I used wireless as my example because it's so finicky sometimes, especially finicky mostly because of the client devices, but you want to know how all those components work. So that way you can anticipate those issues. And then when you're calling TAC, you know, when you're calling Juniper TAC, and they're looking at your design, there's no, you know, major surprises there.
Yeah. Right. And the other thing as well is, you know, we talked about how certain equipment has changed. Like you know the network concepts, right? Then when you get into, you know, we talked about using PBR for basically a poor man's SD-WAN back in the day, and now we've got all these bells and whistles and widgets that do all this stuff automatically. So sometimes, if you have no experience with the technology, sometimes it's really good to work with your partner, kind of get some idea on what they would recommend, and then you can go back to that design guide and go, oh geez, I can go to this chapter and actually look at how my partners are recommending we do this particular task. Right. And then you don't just sit at the end of the table and go, okay man, I trust you. You can actually interact with them and come up to a better design because you've taken some of their recommendations and you cross-checked it with what the vendor says is capable of.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it presupposes a certain level of engineering knowledge, though. You know, you can't just jump into a validated design guide and then start copying and pasting. I guess you can. I've done that. Let me say that again. You can copy and paste config snippets that, you know, okay, this, and then you kind of change IP addresses and things like that. Maybe you change the router name in this snippet. I have done that a lot, but again, it starts with the understanding of what's going on. I understand. Oh, okay, this is why they're doing this in the design guide. Oh, I see. Okay, this is where that adjacency happens. Or you can say, oh, I'm not doing that. This design guide says to use EIGRP everywhere, and we're not going to lock ourselves in. We want to be open standards, like you said, or maybe not. Maybe we don't care. But just as an example, that is, it gives you the knowledge to then be able to understand what you're reading in this design guide. So yes, it's super helpful. It's foundational, but it does presuppose that you do have a certain level of engineering knowledge and understanding. I mean, would you consider that a weakness of a validated design guide? I mean, I don't know. In asking you that question, I'm almost like, I mean, what would we expect? Like that you literally just buy this complete like box of networking and everything works and like your entire data center just gets shipped in one day and dropped in place and it all works. Like, no, it's a system. So I guess it can't really be of a weakness that it requires you to know engineering. But
well, I'll tell you this, just as an amusing anecdote, when back in, man, it must have been 1996. That's really when I started getting into computers after swearing off that I would never do computers at all. I went through like the MCSE track back in Windows NT 4 days, NT 3.5.1, and my first IT job. I was a systems administrator up in Danbury, Connecticut. After a troubleshoot on a domain controller, I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. I actually want to get into networking. But I had no networking experience. And, you know, back in the day, Cisco had really, really good design guides and technical documentation. I remember reading those things, like every one of them. And the first Cisco press book I got, I started reading through that, and I'm like, man, I read all these white papers already. You guys just printed it out and bound it. Because I read all that stuff, my first networking job, I had zero experience, but I knew the technology. I knew how IPv4 worked, and I knew how IPX-SPX worked. And so I talked myself into that job and then was able to still do day-to-day things. You know, so they do help, and they do give you a sense of kind of confidence that the technology may be new to you, but you know what's going on. And then, you know, with a little more experience, you can start to figure out, is this, you know, how do I need to change up this design that's in this guide to fit the business need?
Yeah. And that's why I said earlier that, you know, maybe a design guide is going to give you, a vendor design guide or a validated design guide, excuse me, it's going to give you like maybe 80% get you 80% of the way there. Yeah. And then you adjust. And that's still a huge benefit, right?
Yes.
It's better than 0%. And you're literally on a, you know, on a piece of paper, scribbling out lines and dashes and boxes right. inside a box.
Visio, you know? Visio is not your friend sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, the thing is, though, we've been talking about, you know, vendor design guides. So do you think that, you know, in my experience, you're looking at a Cisco or a Juniper design guide, they're talking about Cisco or Juniper, right? Mm-hmm. Or Arista or whatever. They're vendor focused. You think that that is somehow a negative in the sense that maybe it is lacking in just kind of the pure engineering of packets and protocols and how do we design this solution, you know?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, if you can imagine, you got a staff of people with a particular vendor that are building out these, doing all the testing, all the lab work, you know, all the stuff. They're building networks that can be supported. To write that for every particular vendor, like where do you stop, right? So I think at least with the guide, with those types of guides, and they are a guide, right? It's not the Bible. It's to mm-hmm. help you build these things. I don't see a way for any OEM to be able to test against every particular competitor. This is why we have the IEEE and all these RFCs because you can't actually test with every vendor. If everybody writes the same type of nut and bolt, but the shape is a little bit different because of the vendor, or the color is a little different for the vendor, at least you know, hey, this bolt is still going to work with this particular nut.
So the concepts in the validated design guides are going to be somewhat ubiquitous among vendors.
Yes.
There's going to be a little bit of a change, like you said, a nut and bolt here, or maybe the commands are slightly, the syntax, I mean, of commands are slightly different, but the general concepts are the same.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and ultimately you are... Who's going to write a completely vendor-neutral one? I mean, there's an incredible cost and effort that's required. So maybe it's done by the community. I know there are organizations and consortiums and conferences that do that sort of thing together, maybe the IEEE itself. But then that is such a heavy lift where it needs to be taken in the context of every network vendor that's out there and then every time they update their code. And so that's insane.
It would be constant and... But you know, again, if you are in a vendor neutral environment, right? But you know, a lot of people will do Juniper, Cisco, Arista powered networks, and then maybe they'll use a Palo Alto firewall. Okay, well, Palo Alto does routing, and they do have a standard, OSPF, BGP, whatever. So you can exchange routes, and then it's just typically what you'll see is like we mentioned before. There will be interoperability guides, but they aren't put into the validated design guide. Okay, so interop is going to be a specific use case for your particular deployment. So you build it this way with our stuff. You build it this way, and if we need to talk with someone else, well, here's some things that you need to be aware of to get your packets inspected by the firewall.
Yeah,
for service channels,
Exactly, service chain. In working with enterprises, both small, medium, and very, very large, I haven't seen as much need for interoperability,
correct,
I think, as the industry says we need. I really don't. So to have literally just a random mix of operating systems and vendors, hardware, in your switching environment, in your WAN environment, I don't see that. I usually see one particular vendor for... like one network block. All my closets, IDFs, MDFs, are this brand, and maybe this model even. But whatever, there's some uniformity there. All my data center, it might be a completely different brand, but I usually see uniformity within the data center.
Yes.
But then for all our firewalls, we're going to go with this. So I see these like network blocks that are broken up, and then you see kind of some uniformity of vendor and platform within that block. But maybe each individual block is different. So you might not be Cisco or Juniper from campus to WAN to security to endpoint. Though you could be. And I had many customers that were back in the day. But I do see that as real life interoperability requirement. Can my switching environment talk to my firewall?
About the only time I see interop needs, like in a data center or in a campus or whatnot, it's usually when like the enterprise is moving from one vendor to another, so they don't do a rip and replace. Right, it'll be sure. like, okay, so now I've got Cisco and Juniper sitting in the same, at least side by side with each other, doing the same functions. And then you'll cut all the patch cables from one into another. So now you've got now you kind of have a group of devices from different vendors, but it's usually as things are shifting from one side to the other.
Yeah, I've been there. You know, working with customers that were all HP switching, and then switched to all Cisco switching.
Yeah.
I have had a lot of folks that new CIO comes in and they want to do anything but Cisco, yep. right? They're an ABC yep. philosophy person, and they're like, "All right, we're going to get all of it out." And so you're in a transition phase. And then again, we're talking about Ethernet and packets and TCP/IP. So I didn't actually ever experience any interoperability issues of going from like my switching environment, which is vendor A, to my distribution environment or my WAN environment that was vendor B. It never had any
right,
issues because it's just we're not talking about completely different protocols. So
yeah, it's the underlying stuff that just kind of works. Right? And this is why you don't want to do something like EIGRP or do those very vendor specific doing those open standards. Really prevents you from vendor lock-in, which gives you the end user a whole lot of flexibility if they need to move from one side to another.
Yeah. I mean, and I appreciate flexibility, but I actually recorded a podcast recently where my position was I don't care that much about vendor lock-in. If it solves my problem, I'm choosing one vendor anyway, so I actually don't care that much. Because again, within one block, if I buy all my switching from one vendor, all my WAN devices from one vendor, fine. I get a discount. And sure, I understand there's a heavy lift, but that's the balancing act that we do when we're making these decisions and designing
right.
stuff.
Yeah.
So
yep.
Do you think that validated design guides then are truly, truly realistic since they've been deployed or developed rather in like lab scenarios and not necessarily real life scenario. I mean, you did mention case studies, so maybe I'm misspeaking here. But what do you think?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways that case studies happen. I'll just pick on Juniper for now because everybody else may do it just a little bit differently. But like if we have a pretty good account or good customer, they're kind of friendly. They had good experience. Yeah, we'll just say that they've been using the product for a while. So we will work with those customers to go, hey, what was the problem that you were trying to solve? What did the data center, what did this particular technology, why did you choose the type of technology and how was it deployed? And then how did it work? So those case studies usually come from a, like it's in the wild and these things we're seeing, this is how it's used. Sometimes you'll see the case studies will actually come out of the lab and there's all kinds of tools to make, to try and break certain, like artificially break networks, right? Packet generators and all kinds of stuff. Sometimes when you're looking at a case study, it's good to see the label of the company that's being sort of interviewed and telling you how it worked for them. But those are very helpful. Yeah, again, when they're doing these things in the lab, they really are trying to make sure that all the main points of a good network design, reliability, speed, reconvergence time, what are the best ways to make this thing work well? Like I said, so the network engineers can sleep at night because no network ever breaks during the day. It always breaks mm-hmm. at like 2 o'clock in the right. morning. It just never turns out that way. So yeah, I think design guides are pretty trustworthy because they go through a lot of effort to get these things written.
Hey Brian, you know what? I think what I'd like to do is have you on again sometime in the not too distant future to talk specifically about good data center network design because I know that's your background, and I wanted to talk to you about good network design in general. I wanted to talk about validated design guides today. But I want to maybe talk to you again, if you don't mind, about what a good data center network looks like and really focus on that.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So in any case, thank you for joining me today, though. This has been great. I love talking shop. So if folks want to reach out to you with a question about network design or any other comment, how can they find you online?
So you can find me on LinkedIn. You can email me as well, bgleason@juniper.net. You can pick me up there. We're packets@bytesofcloud.net. That's BYTES, not BITES.
Got it. Okay, great. And you can still find me on Twitter at @network_Phil. If you're on Blue Sky, I'm on Blue Sky now as well. LinkedIn, just search my name and my blog, networkphil.com. Now, if you have an idea for a show, for an episode, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you'd like to be a guest on an episode of Telemetry Now, just reach out to us at telemetrynow@kentick.com. So for now, thanks for listening and bye-bye.